From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's always good to have old friends join us, especially friends you've seen on the big screen and on stage and on television and in commercials. Well, I would say more to my guest, Zach Braff. Clearly, we're out of time. His new feature as writer and director is A Good Person. First of all, welcome back. Good to see you again.
Thank you, Elvis, for having me. I just love talking to you. Thank you.
Oh, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. And I just want to ask you this thing that's run through your movies, which is there is a prologue. It's just the moment before the protagonist is about to have the breath knocked out of them.
Yeah.
I mean, that's sort of what happens at the beginning of Garden State, but something has happened before that.
Yeah.
And then there's a moment of, well, and this, it's a happy occasion, though. Something's happened before.
Yeah.
And then that protagonist gets the breath knocked out. And then your second feature, too. What is that moment you have where people seem to think that they're catching their equilibrium and have the rug pulled from under them?
Maybe it's, I never thought of it like that. And of course, your first question is great and one I haven't thought of before. You're Elvis Mitchell. I think the answer is that I'm not interested in exactly, in this particular film, I didn't want to go down the road of what, of exploring what happened. I'll just say it because it's in the trailer. There's a car accident that is life-changing for all our key players. I didn't want to explore the time right after that. That wasn't really what was interesting to me. I wanted to explore 1 year later how their lives have been transformed and how that was the real meat of the story for me. So I treat the beginning of the movie as a prologue.
In fact, there are two prologues, because there's the narration prologue, which also bookends the movie.
Yes.
And then there's another kind of prologue that that follows that setup.
Yeah, well, I wanted to introduce Morgan and his voiceover that opens the film and that would bookend the film. And then I go into Florence Pugh's story. And that sort of sets up these two human beings that we're going to spend the movie with, where they are before. And then the tragedy occurs. And then I jump to a year later because that's what the period I wanted to be in. I wanted to talk about what happens after everything has been fallen and how are they living now?
But there has been this precipitous sort of like upending of somebody's life.
Yeah.
And I just wonder why that for you is kind of ground zero for you as a dramatist.
I don't know. And it's very often death. I think in all it's death. I suppose it's just, I'm interested in people falling down and how they stand back up. I think that's the runner through my work is that I'm most interested in exploring how we human beings get back up after we've really been knocked down and how we continue to go on.
But also for me, it's about this thing where these people are telling themselves that they're okay when they're not. Mm. And between Allison, played by Florence, and Daniel, played by Morgan, they're both people who are kind of unreliable in terms of what they're saying at the moment they're saying it.
Yeah.
And also we could say the same about your character in Garden State. These people who believe fervently what they're saying, even though if we know them, we know it's not exactly.
They're very unreliable protagonists.
Yes.
And I like that. I love finding stuff out about people. I love giving the audience things, having them think one thing, and then having a story be told, and they go, whoa, I did not know that part of the story. I love the unraveling of a story. And also, you know, that's so human, right? Nobody, we're all not perfect. We all have stories that we're ashamed of and things we wouldn't want to tell strangers. We wouldn't want to tell an audience of people. So I like having them come out as the story sort of unfolds.
I guess that fascinates me too, because there's always this kind of fine line between anxiety and depression and comedy and drama, not melodrama, but comedy and drama in the scene. Not to give too much away, but there's one scene where after a meeting, Allison comes to Daniel's house and his granddaughter comes. And there's a piece of information about fault that we've been told one thing. And it turns out there's something else entirely that he's been telling his granddaughter.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And there's so much going on. For me, that scene is kind of the fulcrum of the entire movie.
Yeah, thank you. I agree. I just got goosebumps from you talking about my movie.
Maybe you should see it.
I'm embarrassed to admit, Elvis, that you gave me goosebumps talking about my own movie.
We should say, by the way, it's the treatment. My guest is our old friend, writer-director, Zach Braff. His new film is A Good Person. But that scene, really, there's so much going on in it.
You're
because
right.
It's funny how awful it is.
Yeah.
It's funny that he hasn't been straight with his granddaughter.
Or he also hasn't been straight with what he just said to Florence Pugh's character.
Yeah, he hasn't. And we also wonder if he's even been straight with himself.
Exactly.
Because there's this schism between him and his son.
Yeah.
That has to be sort of healed or broached at the very beginning of the movie, too.
Yeah. Well, I'll just address the first thing you said, and that is the comedy and drama thing. I've been, you know, the impetus for writing this was that I've been through a lot of grief in the past 4 years. I lost my father. I lost my sister. I lost one of my best friends to COVID. He was 41 years old, and he is survived by his wife and a little baby. And I just had so much drama swarming around my life. And then the pandemic hit, and I was in lockdown. And this is kind of what gurgled out of me. And I wanted to talk about grief and addiction and those areas, but find a way to do it in a way that wasn't too maudlin, that was kind of like life in a sense. Because when I was going through these tragedies, when we're sitting in the ICU waiting to find out what's going to happen with my sister, and it's one of the lowest moments of my life, one of my family members cracks a joke and we just start belly laughing. There's just a much needed release. It's like letting the steam out of a steam engine, and you're so grateful. And for me as an audience member, I really love it in a drama when there are moments of release, because that feels very human. It reminds me of the very of my experience with tragedy. So that's kind of how I wrote the film. The film is about very serious things, but there are lots of moments of humor to relieve the intensity.
What's interesting, too, is there's a character, the character of Daniel's daughter, who we see only briefly, but she's the center of the movie.
Yeah.
She's the heart of the movie. And yeah. That the movie, and we still feel the memory of her.
Yes.
And the loss of her. Mm. And I would ask you about, because there's a scene between that character and her.
Her name's Molly.
Molly, in the car before the accident.
Yeah.
Actually, there are two scenes. We should have seen that she's the one who sort of keeps the family equilibrium going.
Yeah, she's very, very important. It's interesting. The actress, Michelle Hines, is incredible. She has, in terms of screen time, a relatively small part, but it was so important to have an actress that is so charismatic and mesmerizing that the audience is thinking about her for the whole film.
Because I'm asking about that because the film feels her loss.
Yeah, I said to her the other day, because we've become very good friends, I said, you know, you have a small part in this movie, but the whole movie's about you. And she was laughing. She's like, well, thank you. And I said, you know, it's true, because we only have a few scenes with her to get to quickly fall in love with her. And but you needed an actress with that level of charm and magnetism to make it work.
You can sort of see in some emotional way where she and Daniel would connect, because they both have this kind of center of gravity around them. Mm. And they feel like father and daughter.
Yes.
So every time he talks, he's around, you sort of feel her presence, just because we're reminded of her through him, which I thought, that's why I wanted to ask you so much about the casting, just because these three generations of family.
Yeah.
And you can also see why the granddaughter, the daughter that Molly leaves behind, Ryan, is completely like unmoored once that center of gravity is taken
exactly.
away from her.
I got to say, interesting story. So I wrote this for Florence Pugh, and I imagined it would be, I wrote it to be some old legend. You know, I didn't know who that person would be. I had worked with Morgan before, but Morgan doesn't usually do tiny indie movies, if ever, rarely. And I didn't know that it would be him, but I thought, let me try. But I just had in my mind that it would be some, I wanted the image in that diner booth of this young ingenue that everyone is talking about opposite some amazing legend, senior citizen actor. And when Morgan said yes, he called me and he said, he didn't even say hello. I just picked up the phone and he said, I see myself on every page of this script. And I was like, does that mean yes? And he said, yes, I'm with you. So what was actually wonderful that happened, because I didn't know that half of the cast would be African-American, but once you cast the patriarch, if you will, as an African-American man, that makes the entire whole lineage of the family an African-American family. So that was really just something that was wonderful that happened because of Morgan, because it could have been any, you know, that lead could have been anyone that was extraordinary. I just never imagined I would get someone like Morgan. And then other than he and Molly Shannon, who plays Florence's mother, everyone else auditioned. And it was, you know, during COVID, it was 2021. So everything was over Zoom. I finally discovered this extraordinary actor named Chinaza Uche, who plays Nathan, Florence's fiance. he and Florence read together over Zoom. And then the same thing with Celeste O'Connor, who plays Ryan. She read and she just blew us away. So it was, it's a tricky time to do casting because it all has to happen over Zoom. I guess now people are starting to open up the old school way. You know, Florence had the idea to cut her hair right after the prologue, once we see her a year later. And I said to her, that's such a good idea, Florence, but it's just impossible. We have a 26-day shoot. The continuity of that is going to be a nightmare. And she said, you guys will figure it out. So then I go back to the AD and I go back to everybody and the producers. And I'm like, she really wants to do this. And I think it's a good idea, but how the hell are we going to schedule this? And they go, just tell her it's impossible. It's just crazy. And I went back to them and I said, Florence, it's impossible. She goes, you guys will figure it out. So then we eventually figured it out. But one of the things it meant was that the very beginning in the prologue of them being in love and being so intimate was day one. So the only rehearsal day I had on the whole movie was a day to just get Chinaza and Florence comfortable with each other, because day one of photography, they were playing engaged lovers. And that's normally on a film, you'd say, hey, why don't you guys get to know each other a little bit just in some of the other scenes before we jump into you guys rolling around in bed together and you guys pretending to be lovers.
But it's also these characters, these stories are always kind of in medias res. I mean, it's interesting that if there's a transition that's happening and then which is upended by another more severe transition.
Yeah.
I wonder if there's a part of you that likes the idea of sort of Trojan horsing it a little bit, where you're telling people, there's a big life change that's taking place with these characters. Oh, no, there's a really big one that's happened. And that's been the case for you again and again.
Yeah. Well, I it's funny because in this film, the inciting event is a car accident. You know, I've had people say, why are you in the trailer telling me so much about the movie? And I said to someone on my Instagram, I was like, I promise you, this is not the whole movie. But I understand that, because if I had my druthers, I wouldn't tell you that. But it's hard to make a trailer for this film and not say, okay, you need to at least know that it's about a car accident that upends these two families. And it's about how they deal going forward. But yeah, then that's just actually ultimately a very tiny bit of the story of what happened. So
I guess I want to ask you this as an actor-director. Part of the reason you do that is it's a way to give actors something to play, because there's two things going on so often. Mm. Ostensibly, they're pushing narrative forward, but really it's more about how is this character reacting to what's happening to them emotionally.
Yeah, that's well said.
And it feels to some way like you're trying to get them to sort of step out of just playing one thing, which actors, as you know, so often are asked to do.
Yeah, these are very hard parts. I couldn't play these parts. You know, some people were like,
you can't play one of them.
I don't think I could play. Listen, someone said, what was it like to not be in this movie? And this is not false modesty. I'm saying I think I'm a very decent actor and I love acting. But I had in my quiver Morgan Freeman and Florence Pugh. And I was like, I'm not in this one. I don't want to get anywhere near these two geniuses. I just want to watch them. And so you're right. You give them a lot to play with with people of their ability. They can Trojan horse it. They can be playing multiple things. You know, that diner scene is such a, where they're sitting opposite each other for the first time, is such a chess match. And if you watch it, it keeps the dynamic of who's driving the scene keeps changing back and forth. And it's one of my favorite scenes in the movie because
but he's also playing it like a cop.
He is a cop. I mean, he was a cop.
But,
yeah. I mean,
but we learned that late in the scene. But before he even says it, you go, well, what is he doing? He keeps saying, yeah, but are you high?
Yeah.
Which it's the cop thing.
So he says something like, I was a cop for 40 years. And I was an addict for 50. So I'm going to ask you once again, are you high right now? That's one of the, one thing you have to remember throughout the movie, even though he's an older man and he's retired and he was a badass cop in Newark, and he takes those techniques and skill sets that he learned his whole career to both the accident and to kind of casing who she is as a person,
We'll take a break. Our guest is self-proclaimed very decent actor, Zach Braff. He's turned best at writing and directing.
Very decent actor.
With his new film.
That's on my resume.
With his picture of himself. This is, a good person's a new film. It's The Treatment This Morning. Come stay with us. It's The Treatment. I'm excited because our old friend Zach Braff is back. Yeah, again, self-proclaimed, so very decent actor, but he's also a pretty darn good director and writer, too.
Thank
and his
you.
New film as writer-director is A Good Person. And it's not an ironic title. It was actually something aspirational. And I want to ask you about the title because it's one of these things that says a lot and says almost nothing.
Yeah. That's true. I mean, I don't want to ruin where it comes up in the film, but what I'll say that I say as just a director is the film is about good people who have fallen down and are trying their very best to stand back up. And I just think that's a very relatable thing to everyone, even if you've been lucky and not had tragedy befall you in your life. It could be anything. It could be that horrible breakup. It could be that bad divorce. It could be getting fired. Whatever the thing is in your life, that's something that's really, really been your hard thing. I believe you're a good person who's doing their very best to stand back up. And that's what I think the film is about.
I also think, too, and I was sort of connecting all these movies, they're really about people looking for a best friend. And at the beginning, Allison has that with Molly. Mm. But she's also the person who's everybody's best friend. She's her daughter's best friend. She's her brother's best friend. Mm. She's her father's best friend. Mm. And so often there's that person who is what you call in real life a star.
Mm.
And the movie's kind of built around that person being, it's the father at the beginning of Garden State. It's the person who's this constellation that people are constantly referring back to.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like dealing with the memories of grief. Because the grief has gone away for so long now. In a lot of these cases, it's kind of this vestigial thing.
Mm.
I want to ask you both about that idea. This person who's been, again, this sort of gravitational center of these people's lives have been taken away in these films.
Yeah.
And then also the way people are reckoning with this grief that won't go away.
Well, the grief that won't go away is, I suppose, something I was just trying to deal with myself.
This proceeds, though. This goes back to Garden State, though. I mean, I want to ask you. It's been kind of a part of all three of the indie films that you've done. I want to ask you why it's so much the center of the way these things function.
I think it's just my own battles with my own mental health, to be perfectly frank. Depression and wanting to make something of my life while I'm alive. I feel death looming. I guess that's the neuroses in me. And I've never, you know, people think of me probably most often as the silly guy on Scrubs, but that's not really what my nature is. I have battled depression for a lot of my life. And so when I sit down and finally write things, they are about loss and sad folks who are trying to get by. I guess that's the theme is people that are quote, good people who are trying to get by with the pain they have in their heart.
I guess this, I thought it was interesting too, in A Good Person, that both Allison and Daniel have these, he has the trains and she has the music, these sort of ways so they can express these things the way they want life to be.
Yeah, that's well said, yeah. Wow, yeah. I had a train set when I was a little child and it was my favorite toy. It was, my parents got divorced and my mother and stepfather got it for me. It was one of those, hey, forget about the divorce, look at this thing, presents that kids sometimes get. Mine wasn't nearly as elaborate as Daniel Morgan's characters, but it was just, I just loved it. And it was meditative for me as a sort of a sad kid. It was a meditative thing to play with. I would get lost in it. And I think Daniel has done that himself. He's a recovering alcoholic, and he's sort of funneled his attention into this meticulous train set. Allison as well, she's not a professional songwriter. She doesn't really know what she's going to do with her life yet, but she finds meditation and solace in playing songs on the piano and in writing little songs on the piano. So I think that, you know, I think a lot of people have their thing they do, whether it's a hobby or a sport or meditation itself, exercise for a lot of people that helps them sort of cope with life. And yeah, those are both represented by music and the model trains for Morgan.
I mean, cause it seems that, and there's a little bit of this in Garden State too, that these leaps of imagination become therapeutic for these characters. And obviously that's the case for you too. I mean, what it takes for Daniel to get lost in that city, he even builds his own figures.
Yeah.
And she's performing these songs. We can see how tentative she is at the keyboard at the very beginning when she's doing the song for Nathan. But by the end, she's pouring herself into this, whether she's precise or not.
I guess that's kind of what I do with my writing.
That's what I'm asking.
Yeah. I never thought of it like that. God, you're good. Elvis Mitchell. No, but that's what I'm doing, man. I just like they're pouring themselves into their hobby in this case, I do that with my writing. It's a way to place these feelings somewhere. Morgan's character Daniel doesn't just have a train set. He has a train set where he's, in his mind, created this perfect little utopia where things have worked out way better than he thinks they have in his life. And the figures all represent stories from his life where things worked out better than they actually have for him. And Florence's character, Allison, writes songs that are therapeutic and cathartic. And I think that's really well thought of. I suppose I do that for myself. This is definitely a sort of therapeutic, cathartic assignment for myself that I wrote during the pandemic.
I just wonder, in watching it now, can you feel the moments where you wrote a particular scene, what you were going through as these things were happening for you in the creation?
Yeah, and you know what's really moving is watching it with an audience and seeing their reaction is the real catharsis, because that's where you find community. And, you know, if anything, this was written in sadness and in loneliness and in isolation and in grief. And then you watch it with an audience and you see them be moved in the right spots. You see them laugh in the right spots, and you see them pin drop silent in the right spots. And that's where I feel in my heart, like community, like, oh, I'm not alone. I've written something that people can relate to and see themselves in. And so that's what feels wonderful.
It's the treatment that my guest is our old friend Zach Braff's new film as writer-director is a good person. You can also see the show at kcrw.com/thetreatment. As you were saying that, I thought the one thing about this movie that kind of separates it from the others is this full of people who have the ability to sort of say kind of the wrong thing or something that can be really injurious in a really sort of blithe way.
Yeah.
And even that scene with Zoe Lister-Jones, where she's talking to Allison saying, listen, I don't have time for this. Either you're going to do this or you're not.
Yeah.
There's this directness that a lot of these characters have in this, that scene with Alex in the bar with her high school friends.
With Alex Wolff, who does an amazing...
Oh, my God. That's almost like something out of a fairy tale where he's going from being the sheep to the wolf.
Well, I that's one of my favorite scenes in the movie. Alex, a brilliant actor, Alex Wolff, does a one-scene part that is just in really intense. It takes place in a dive bar. And for me, you know, that talk about a chess match. She was like the popular pretty girl back in high school, and these were sort of the druggy guys. They start toying with her because they see that she's fallen to their level. Wow. I mean, watching Alex Wolff and Florence Pugh go toe-to-toe was just really, really thrilling.
But that's also really, too, a scene about both of those things. And I wanted to sort of talk about that juxtaposition, because it happens about halfway in where Zoe shows up and starts talking to her about what she's got to do to get her life together. But she's basically, in effect, saying the same thing. You got to admit what you are.
Absolutely. Well, I think that's important for anyone's life. If you're going to start to make a change, you have to start with being incredibly honest with yourself. That's something that I've meditated on a lot. There's an expression I learned in some self-help course that I always think of, which is, what are you pretending not to know? And I recommend that to everyone. If you want to shake shit up in your life, you just sit and think about, what are you pretending that you don't know? And I think that's crucial. It's basically saying, if I'm as brutally honest with myself as I can be, what is the truth and what should I really do about it? And I think that definitely comes through in the film.
There's so much these movies for me, these characters, it's about growing up a lot in a very short period of time.
Mm-hmm.
That happens in Garden State, it happens in here, and it happens here. Mm. People that grow up, they should have been grown up, more grown up than they are at this point, but they're about
major life changes. It's probably a fantasy of mine in some ways, because I, whatever chapter of life I'm in, I'm always looking for some epiphanous thing to happen and for me to make a big stride.
You're looking for that rather than waiting for them to happen?
I think when I write these movies, they often come at a time, you know, I wish I was more prolific, but in order for me to actually sit down and dedicate the amount of time it takes and the work it takes and the focus it takes, it's almost like my body's just gurgling up, I have to say something. And I think that happens at strategic moments in my life, the three films that I've written. Again, I Wish I Was Here I wrote with my brother. But so I think at this time it was like, oh, everything in my body was like, oh, I have to get this out on paper, what I want to say about addiction, what I want to say about grief, what I want to say about pain, and what I want to create as a hopeful place to aim for, a hopeful, peaceful future that I hope to at least set my sights towards.
It's funny you're saying that, because I was thinking the word peaceful, because that opening narration, that sort of prologue, by Morgan, by Daniel, and we hear it again at the end of the movie, but it has a very different meaning by then.
Yeah, you know, I know this is a mild spoiler, so maybe skip the next 30 seconds if you want to, but it's a very mild spoiler, and that is that I don't know that I intended that to be for the audience to think by the end, when it's being read in a letter, that it is the same beat as the beginning of the film. I don't know how many people will track that, but in my mind, that's what I intended.
Near the end, when you finally see her playing, yeah. and again, like the beginning, it's a rush of things that happens.
Yeah.
At the end, I mean, it's an action-packed opening.
Yeah.
And the last 4 minutes is a ton of stuff packed in.
Yeah. Well, I think of that as an epilogue in a sense. For me, there's like prologue, then the chunk of the story I'm telling you, and then I give you an epilogue to let you know how things are ending up in this 2-hour story.
You do that kind of thing a lot with a ton of incident. Encapsulate at the very beginning of the movie and the very end of the movie. This kind of almost
I'll tell you a funny story.
Sure.
I've been told this many times before, but Garden State had a scene at the end that was really jarring and was really powerful and intense. And it was always in the script, and I shot it. And when I was showing the movie to friends, lots of people, but most importantly Bill Lawrence, who's a mentor and
creator of Scrubs,
the creator of Scrubs
and Ted Lasso
and Shrinking and other great things. But he's been a huge mentor and friend to me. He watched the movie and he said, "That's one of the most powerful scenes in your movie, but it'll never be in your movie." Because it was a scene where, I guess I'll just tell you that it was, for those who know the movie, but he... you know, because the mother had drowned in the bathtub, and it had just been an accident. But we knew that she was a woman who was clinically depressed and wanted to end her own life. So in the film, there was right before the end, there was a flashback, and we hear the mother drowning, and Ian Holm rushes, because he hears her, to the doorframe of the bathroom and clutches the doorframe and stops himself, because he knows that she has tried several times and really wants to leave this life. And he clutches the doorframe and doesn't go in and allows her to go and goes and sits back down on the bed. And then when she stops screaming, he calls 911. Now, if the audience could only see Elvis Mitchell's drop-jawed face right now. Now, it was incredibly intense and incredibly powerful, but it completely hijacked the end of the film and ruined the love story that had been built. And I had it in until the very end, and it was Bill, amongst other people, that said that has to go.
Well, watch this for a segment, and we have to go. I have no way to top that, so I'm just going to say...
Sorry, there's an exclusive for KCRW.
Thank you, and KCRW listeners, keep those pledges coming in. My guest is our old friend and, you know, very decent actor, but pretty good director.
Very decent actor.
Pretty good writer-director, Zach Braff. His new film as writer-director is A Good Person. Zach, thanks so much for doing this.
I love talking with you. Thanks so much.
Actor Zach Braff's newest project is as a director. The film is A Good Person. This is The Treatment, and you can hear previous episodes at kcrw.com/thetreatment. And what we would love from you is a donation. It is our spring drive, and you can donate now or anytime. Again, it's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. In the book Black Founder by my guest, Stacey Spikes, there's a line I happen to particularly like and I know describes him very well. I have always been enamored by data. There's probably no better way to describe the life of a man who has used data to move himself from one step in his career to another, as the book lets us know, and it takes us from the path to working in video and at the ground floor to becoming the founder of the Urban World Film Festival and co-founder of MoviePass, my guest, of course. Again, terrific title, Black Founder. My guest is Stacey Spikes. So good to talk to you, Stacey. Thank you so much for doing this.
Hey, Elvis. Thank you for having me.
And again, that describes who and what you are to me. I have always been enamored by data.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, you know, there was a book I read once where someone said, even if people don't believe you have the truth, if you have the data, then you know the truth. And And there's something about the power of having the numbers. And, you know, we used to always say, you know, what was the Siskel and Ebert review of a movie, right? And now my mom will call me up with the weekend grosses and what the per screen average is. And, you know, it's like the average person is looking at even the movie industry from a data perspective. So it's pretty exciting.
What's really sort of key to that data is the way that one has to deal with data in both the entertainment and tech sectors as a person of color.
Oh, yeah, definitely. You know, and some of the data, which thank goodness that we have it, is not great, which is seeing some of the data about tech founders being funded. And the numbers are really low. Women and minority founders combined make up only 3% of venture capital that's deployed. So those are kind of scary low numbers. And I always think, coming from the music industry, you know, there's a lot of talent that is sitting there that once it gets the opportunity, it can kind of unlock worlds that we might not imagine.
Sure. And I was asked the thing of something in the book when that you mentioned during your time at Motown, when you were talking to Gerald Busby, who was running the label. He said to you, you shouldn't be any place for more than 4 years without an ownership stake.
Yeah, that was, I couldn't believe he, you know, I maybe had been there for about a year and we were at some reception and he leans over and he starts his conversation. And to hear a boss say that, knowing you don't own any of this company where you are, but I'm like, are you telling me I should leave? But what he said was, it always rang true for me and stayed in the back of my mind, that the subtitle of the book is, you know, the hidden power of being an outsider. And people said, well, what is an outsider? I said, if you don't have ownership or a stake at sitting at the table, you're an outsider. And that always resonated with me as I continued through my career. I didn't own anything. You know, I was a paycheck or a downturn in the economy away of, you know, being in a tough spot.
You came up at a time where Black entrepreneurship was really starting to rise. I mean, because of hip hop, there were things like Vibe magazine and George Jackson, both of them, which are mentioned in the book. People were starting to sort of say that, given the amount of sway that Black creativity has in the entertainment world, there should be some ownership. There should be some return of that. There also should be some way to take the ideas that go into creating and bring that into the idea of marketing and reaching out to the public. The book really gets at how crucial it was for you to come up through this period.
I think being at a company like Motown, you saw that people of color could run things at the top of, you know, top of the food chain. Then, as you said, seeing Vibe magazine and Michael Jordan and boxing, it was Mike Tyson, and with, you know, Michael Jackson covering the music. Everywhere you went, you saw talent at playing at a very high level. And so, since we've had this technology shift, you haven't seen that continue, and that a lot of that ownership got lost. You know, things like Vibe, and there was so much of the carpet kind of rolling back in this dream that was kind of promised or to be hoped for. So I think we got to do a lot of work to get back to a similar place with technology.
Yeah, it's interesting, too, because talking about ownership and what happened with Vibe and so many companies, Essence Magazine, so many companies that were started by people of color that end up being bought or really subsumed. And that those are issues you have to deal with in your companies at Urban World and at MoviePass.
Urban World's around now 25, 26 years.
And 26 so years this year, yeah.
Yeah, we were born out of that Vibe era. And if you remember, there was Vibe, there was 360 Hip Hop, there was Source Magazine, there was Complex, there was Jack the Rapper Conference, there was How Can I Be Down. It was a different world then. And but we're still trying to make sure that people didn't go anywhere. We're still consuming products. But to have our voice at the table as consumers and as creators is just still really important, because if you don't tell your story, someone else will. And I think we do a better job of telling our own stories.
And selling our own stories is the treatment. My guest is the author of Black Founder, The Hidden Power of Being an Outsider, Stacey Spikes, who founded the Urban World Film Festival and Urban World Films, and also co-founder of MoviePass. And then reading the book, I thought I should have been called a man ahead of his time, because Urban World is an idea that clearly that bell was waiting to be rung, and in some ways still waiting to be rung. I want to ask you about this, given that, you know, the kinds of things that happen in places like Sundance, where they're now actually trying to bring in people of color to run the festival and to say it should be diverse in ways that they didn't before. It still feels to me like that nexus of Black sort of entrepreneurship and Black leadership and Black creative talent, there's still a place for that.
I think any sector that wants to be successful is just going to be more successful if you've got a lot of diversity sitting at the table. You're just going to build a better business. You're going to build a business that includes more people. You're going to build one that has better access to talent. It's just going to be a better company and a better sector. And, you know, we saw some things early on where you started to see the training of algorithms, and they were learning off of data sets that didn't look like the general population. So you started to get misfires of that. And if you don't catch the digital revolution early, it's going to build in the code layer prejudices and leaving people out that you don't realize is going to happen. And so that's different than you used to be able to go in and complain to somebody or talk, or somebody knew you and maybe you got your foot in the door. You're going to have these things where decisions are more and more not in the loop as much, as they like to say, there's not a human in the loop as much. So that's I think it's really important.
One of the points you make in the book, which is, I think, always been the way, it just doesn't get reported, or it gets reported and it gets forgot, which is the sad thing about, of course, being a person of color, is that as often as not, and you cite the example of the original Kings of Comedy versus Castaway and the returns on both of those, so often is this impact that Black culture has that cannot be really narrowed into algorithm, which probably goes into entrepreneurship, which is the wild and original idea that an algorithm will reject or say that there's only going to be this much return on. In fact, as often as not, in culture, people of color, those algorithms have always been upended.
Even when you look at the decision to go put a grocery store in a part of town or to invest in a community or banks, you'll get, and you can even see with some political comments being made now, like if you're involving other people or you're focused on people of color, then that's why you're losing track of your business. And how often have you seen where, you know, whether it's the music industry or the movie industry or other sectors, where the return on investment was so high that you would outperform the market? Because when we go into a product, whether it be Twitter or Facebook, we're often early adopters to the technology and we can become a ground bed of those things. But then you'll get overlooked when it comes to, hey, what if we want to make a version of it? Or what if we make our own? And then that part gets overlooked and it creates an imbalance. But the data there in the performance is there, but you would hear, well, Black stories don't travel. And, you know, in recent time, when Marvel released Black Panther, not only was it enormously successful at the box office worldwide, but it also is their number one streaming movie on the platform as well. And that's where the data is showing you that those voices and those stories are universal.
I happen to see that MSNBC interview you did when you when MoviePass was just going out. And I remember being appalled in real time by that. Like you being treated as almost as, well, you know,
it wasn't said, but it was clearly implicit. You're a black person. What could you possibly know about doing something like this? And so to read you, it gave me PTSD just reading that portion of the book where you relive that. And you're very kind and politic, in fact, about not saying that that was racism being exercised. But the look, I remember the look on your face when they cut to you, like, wait, did I hear the question I thought I heard? You were just as shocked by it as anybody else. First of all, I was thrilled to see you on talking about MoviePass and what it was going to be. But that interview not only informed the way that MoviePass is treated, but also the kind of valuations it got when people try to come in and elbow you out of your own company and always offer you less than it was worth.
I remember being on live TV, and it was like, what she really asked was, did you break in and steal this? And I'm like, you can't steal access to someone's code, you know? But it was like, you know, you don't belong here. How did you get in here? It was crazy. But you don't have the time to get into it, you know, if it's a dinner conversation, maybe. But yeah, there's these times where I choose to look at it as pattern recognition more than what I'll call racism. Because I think if somebody thinks you're a black person that can help them in some way, they love you. Who cares? But if you are a bet with capital and you didn't go to Stanford, you didn't go to Harvard, you didn't drop out of Yale, you didn't drop out of Princeton, and you don't look the part, then there's pattern recognition there. And so that's why when someone asked me, we had gone back and forth about the book cover, I said, I want people to know what founders look like other than certain people we know. I was doing an interview with someone and I said, if you and I walk out on the street right now and we say, describe what a tech founder looks like. I said, it was a woman who was interviewing me. I said, they're not going to describe me and they're not going to describe you. And that's that mental pattern recognition is so important that we have to fight to change.
My guess, by the way, who's not calling racism racism, is the author of the book, Black Founder, The Hidden Power of Being an Outsider, Stacey Spikes, just the treatment, which you can also hear at kcrw.com. But in so many of these instances, and you actually don't say it as you were putting together these meetings to go out to raise some money to get MoviePass off the ground, but it's clearly implicit. I mean, it's just basically subtext for people of color reading it, that you ran up against so many walls that would not have been there had you looked different, as you looked the way you're talking about.
100%. And there's a couple of examples, and I'll never forget Jeff, who was on my team, who did go to an Ivy League school and did look the part. I remember he and I were in San Francisco making rounds, and he was on our finance team. We walked into a meeting, and one of the associates walked right up to Jeff and put his hand out and said, hey, Stacy, it's nice to meet you. And as Jeff was shaking his hand, he said, that's Stacy, I'm Jeff. But the stereotype was that powerful that he walked into the room and the first person he thought must be the founder was Jeff, you know, the white guy. And there were so many examples of that. And that thing that you're sitting after the meeting or after they've given you feedback and, you know, you've left and you're back home and you're going back and forth and they're saying, well, what about this or what about that? You knew that what you had built had more traction than you'd seen with some kids that are coming out of college just because they were pedigree. And you had gross $3 billion or more in your career. You had an incredible track record, and yet you're still at the table trying to, you know, fight for that 1%, 2%, 3% that they might hand out. And so I know I'm in a very fortunate situation to have been able to access some of that capital, but it's astounding what you have to go through. And it's kind of scary in some ways. I didn't believe that ceiling was there, but I met it when I really became a tech founder and had to raise capital. It's one thing when you're just working for people. It's another thing when you're out there raising money.
It's funny, though, because you detail your time at Miramax. You talk about in the book about what you had to do when you're meeting, after meeting with Jeff Gilmore and sort of seeing what wasn't there. I guess I'm asking this, I'm wondering, was it one thing that was in the abstract to sort of think about it? And because you knew the way you were being dealt with, Gilmore saying, well, you know, we get so many submissions, and you think to yourself, well, there can't be that many bad submissions by Black people. And also the way you're being treated at Miramax, which is the sort of thing where you're being called an idiot and also seeing what the room looks like around you. Was it really that shocking to you that it was that tough to get this thing going? I mean, it's such a great idea. And I love the partner book when you say to your wife, you know, why isn't there a Netflix for moviegoers? And she just went, yeah, why isn't there?
I guess because I had such a successful career, I thought it would be easier. You know, it's kind of like you walk into the bank and you say, I want to open a farm stand. And they say, well, do you have experience as a farmer? And you say, well, yes, I do. And they say, well, good. Well, how successful? And I say, well, I worked at these three companies and I was a top salesperson and I raised the produce and took it to market and did all of the marketing and I was great. But now I want to go out on my own. And so you would think that it would be easier. And that's when kind of this brutal reality kind of came into view, when it was, okay, there's something else at play here that's not experience, a track record you can count on, something that you can say, hey, he did Spike Lee's soundtracks, he did Boyz II Men, he did Queen Latifah's Grammy-winning album, he then went to Miramax and he did, you know, Trainspotting and The Crow. And like there's this batting average that is not a mistake. Sometimes people get one of those in their entire career. And when you walk into the room, that was the part that I realized, okay, this is a different game. And that's where it was really shocking. Because I did have the relationships to get into any studio and any theater and said, why don't we have a Netflix for movie theaters, right? And so it just became odd to me. It was like, wow, I didn't know we were still this far behind in our country in many ways.
You, as an entrepreneurial force, have created two things, two entities that people still talk about so fondly. Both ideas that really, the kind of, if you build them, they will come ideas. People were kind of waiting for them. This thing that people wanted to hear and wanted to see. And you kind of close the book with, you know, not only you're getting a new company pre-show going, but about the fondness people have for MoviePass. I mean, especially now, given where theaters are. And when you talk about what you think it is in you that sort of leads you to come up with these things that people really want, because I thought that was, you talk about having, you can't just sort of luck into the kind of successes you've had in your business career, but as a creative person, you created two entities that people still have an enormous amount of affection for.
I think it was, why doesn't this exist? It just makes sense that it should. And I guess sometimes that's that curse of, you know, those of us who are entrepreneurs, we talk about, you walk around the world saying, why not? And you keep seeing things that aren't there. And then you go, well, it's not here. I have to build it. And especially if it keeps you up at night. And Urban World, you know, when I would go to Sundance or I would go to any of the major festivals, it was like, we had this joke, the few of us, we called ourselves the raisins in the milk. And we just weren't around. And you'd have this one big spotlight film, like I remember being in Sundance and seeing Gina Prince-Bythewood's first film out of the gate with Love and Basketball. And the auditorium's filled. And I'm like, other than the cast, there's no people of color here, right? And it's this showcase of, look how open we are, right? And yet, there was not a people's festival. Where's soul food? Where's How Stella Got Her Groove Back? Where's a home for all of that stuff? Mi Familia and all of these films. And that was, why isn't there? I've been to all of these festivals around the world and you just don't see us. And it was the same thing with MoviePass. It was like, there's 200 million people that go to the movies on a regular basis. There's no reason there's not a subscription for that, because we're having trouble getting people in the seats. We're raising prices. We're charging more for food and we're pricing it out for young people. But Netflix and Disney Plus and everybody else had the right idea, which was, let's focus on volume and frequency rather than incremental spend and pricing people out of the marketplace. And that's all I saw was, okay, you need an end of the spectrum. That's your wholesale volume side of the business, you know, and you could call that a loyalty program for the whole industry. Go more, save more, right? So it seems like just common sense to me, but no one had built it. And it's like, okay, I'll build it.
Well, he built it twice and then he wrote a book about it. I guess Stacy Spikes, his book is Black Founder, The Hidden Power of Being an Outsider. Stacy, I can't thank you enough for doing this. Thank you so much.
Elvis, thank you. She's playing hard to get.
She wants a tea and a toe. The founder of MoviePass, Stacy Spikes, is also the author of the memoir, Black Founder, The Hidden Power of Being an Outsider. Past episodes for The Treatment are at kcrw.com/thetreatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell, and with The Treat, it's Fade In podcast host, Mark Ramsey.
I'm Mark Ramsey, and this is The Treat. When I was a kid, my mom took me to the Dryden Theater at the George Eastman House in Rochester, New York. That's where I grew up. We were there that night to see a movie, but not just any movie. We were there to see Citizen Kane. And we weren't alone. There was a special guest, Ruth Warwick. Now, at the time, Ruth was most famous for daytime drama, but to any movie fan, she would always be known as the first wife of Charles Foster Kane. She was the last surviving major actor from the film, and there she was, right at the front of the theater. She watched the movie with us. Orson Welles, the force behind Citizen Kane, created novelty out of the familiar. He carried that skill into the new entertainment medium of radio.
The Columbia Broadcasting System and its affiliated stations present Orson Welles and the Mercury Theater on the air in The War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells.
He catapulted to national fame thanks to his radio version of War of the Worlds, which was in a faux breaking news style and actually convinced, unfortunately, more than a few people that aliens had in fact landed in Grover's Mill, New Jersey.
We know now that in the early years of the 20th century, this world was being watched closely by intelligences greater than man's and yet as mortal as his own.
His deal with RKO was just total artistic freedom. He was the envy of Hollywood. He wasn't even 25. He was a boy genius, and he could make anything he wanted. And what he made was Citizen Kane, still today regarded as one of the best movies ever made.
He happens to be the president, Charles, not you.
That's a mistake that will be corrected one of these days.
You, Mr. Bernstein.
There's a scene at a breakfast table, and it's only 2 minutes long and has almost no dialogue, but it vividly shows the dissolution of Kane's marriage to the character played by Ruth Warwick. It's just brilliant.
Yes.
Really, Charles? People will think...
What I tell them to think.
At the front of the Dryden Theater in Rochester, New York, on that day, all those years ago, that was the moment that I met Orson Welles.
Past editions of The Treat, such as with podcast host Rico Galliano, are at kcrw.com/thetreat. The Treat takes us into the minds of creators and the events that whip their psyches into a creative tradewind, and what moves them in a way that moves us. Rebecca Mooney produces and edits the show, which is mixed by Katie Gilchrist. Help this week from Anna Boss and Laura Kandarajan. To better days, everyone, I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.